You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
I'm Janine Tesori, and this is The Fabulous Invalid.
Welcome to The Fabulous Invalid, Broadway's podcast where we present essential conversations with a curated roster of the best, most important, and innovative theater makers working today, from actors to writers, directors, designers, and everyone in between. We took our name from the title of a 1938 play by Kaufman and Hart that has since become a loving nickname for Broadway itself. Always deemed on the verge of decline, yet always bouncing back, The Fabulous Invalid. I'm theater savant Jamie Dumont.
And I'm Rob Russo, writer and theater critic with StageLeft.nyc and StageLeft, the podcast.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, Jamie.
Well, today feels a little bit like Christmas.
Oh my gosh, Christmas in April.
Yes. Yeah. Well, hey, why not? You know, times
we
are
need
tough.
A little Christmas right this very minute. Well,
I have been saying that for 5 weeks now. MAME revival. Okay.
Oh, well,
but
yes.
That's a whole nother. That's a whole nother.
Podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. But today we get to continue our shared obsession with Soft Power, the innovative new musical within a play that ran at the Public Theater last fall, following engagements in Los Angeles and San Francisco in 2018. And this week we are joined by the show's composer and co-lyricist, the extraordinary Janine Tesori.
I love her.
I know. I just have to say, I'm almost more excited for you than I am for me.
I know, right? Wow, so generous. That's because Janine is widely recognized as one of the most talented and prolific composers working in the theater today, with 5 Broadway musicals and 5 Tony Award nominations under her belt, finally winning in 2015 for her score to Fun Home. Her other major credits include the scores to Violet, Shakespeare's Twelfth Night at Lincoln Center, the smash hit Tony Award-winning Thoroughly Modern Millie, her extraordinary collaboration with Tony Kushner on Carolina Change, which we have to talk to her about, and 2008's Shrek the Musical.
I have to stop you there. The fact that the score to Thoroughly Modern Millie came out of the same brain as the person who wrote Carolina Change, I don't know where that talent comes from. I don't understand how someone can be that brilliant.
Right. Well, that's why I love her work, because like I always think of her as the chameleon of the musical theater, right? I mean,
totally.
Shrek. She wrote Shrek the Musical, right? And then Carolina Change or Soft Power, right? I mean,
or Fun Home.
Right. You know, I mean, such a diversity of talent and skill and subject matter. And yet, you know, it all has that same artistry behind it, which is what's so amazing to see someone have such a diverse musical palette. You know,
I don't even have to listen to Fun Home to start crying.
Oh,
I just have to think about it and I weep.
Oh, what a perfect musical. Truly, truly just a perfect musical from start to finish.
I agree. We've wanted Janine on the show since before we even started doing this show. In fact, I remember seeing Soft Power in San Francisco before we started our first recording. And what did I think I texted you immediately.
Yep.
And I was like, we need to call Janine Tesori and David Wong and get them on the show, because I have to talk about Soft Power now.
Right.
That didn't quite work out at that moment in time, but thank God it has. And this is like now full circle moment for us to finally talk to Janine.
Totally. And, you know, and we were fortunate to have a good reason to ask her again. And that was the release of the cast album for Soft Power just last week.
I think I'm on listen number 12.
I've lost count of how many times I've listened to it.
Might be more. I've lost count because there was a moment where I go back and I listen to certain things several times in a row, then I move on.
Totally. Well, we're going to talk through the entire score with Janine to get her insights into the craft behind it all. Maybe we'll get some stories that folks might not know. But first, you know, in case you miss Soft Power in its prior engagements, we thought we'd give a brief overview of the show since we're going to be talking so much about the nitty-gritty of it in this episode.
Well, Rob, tell us what the show is about.
Well, I am not going to deign to have the brilliance to describe it in a pithy way. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to quote David Henry Hwang, who, as you alluded to, we had him on the show in 2018 and then again in 2019. And we asked him to describe the show, and he gave to date what I think is the best description of it. So I will read what he said, which is, "Soft Power is a play that becomes a musical. The first 20 minutes is a comedy that takes place in 2016, and then the show jumps 100 years into the future, and the incident that we saw has since been mythologized and become the source material for a beloved East-West musical in China. So what we're watching for the rest of the show is a future Chinese musical, which celebrates, from a Chinese point of view, how China stepped in to lead the world when America collapsed after the 2016 election." Only David Henry Hwang could string together that paragraph.
Oh, no one else.
Right. And we should add that the substance of the incident he's alluding to is a Chinese film executive attending a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton, who's then running for president. And then that becomes mythologized as like a reverse version of The King and I, where Hillary Clinton and this Chinese business executive, film executive, have a relationship that teaches them both about America and China and themselves. And of course, we should mention that David is a character in the show, since it's in part inspired by his own harrowing experience being the victim of a hate crime, walking down the street in Brooklyn. He was stabbed in the neck and almost died, which is horrifying.
It is horrifying. And if that description doesn't make you, A, want to see this show because it needs another production, Broadway, or listen to the album, which is available now and much easier to do, I don't know what will, because it's really brilliant. And as we've referenced, we had David and Lee Silverman, the director, on our show, joined by Lise Allen Lewis, who plays Secretary Clinton, and Francis Zhu, who plays David Henry Hwang in the piece. And it's definitely worth listening to because it's a really interesting conversation that I think you will enjoy.
Yeah, a good companion piece. Okay, so let's get to our chat with Janine.
Let's. Janine, thank you so much for joining us today.
It is a pleasure.
I had the great pleasure, speaking of pleasure, of tuning into the Public Theater's virtual listening party that you guys had last Friday to celebrate the launch of the album, which was so fun. I felt like I was in a chat room with like all my friends, but my friends just happened to be all these great theater writers and actors, you know. But you texted something in that chat early on that I thought was quite poignant. You wrote, "Theater disappears, but it doesn't disappear in your memory or on a cast album." And we both adore Soft Power. So it certainly lives on in our memories, but we're so thrilled that there's now a cast album to supplement that memory. As a composer with a prolific number of works, how does it feel to have your work memorialized in a cast album?
Well, I think part of the reason I was so glad that you were on that chat too. It was really fun bantering with you. It was a bar without the noise. And I mean, it was really, that was really fun and brought us together. I think a cast album for me is that what's hard about it is it's a little bit written in stone. And I remember when I was a young music director and I would listen to the album and I'd think, that's what they did. They held that note for this long. And I would take all these notes against the score, not realizing that, you know, yes, it's definitive in a way, but it's not as calcified as that. These are works that, according to the audience, that the audience is a scene partner with. With a cast. So yes, they're definitive in terms of the interpretation because we all agree upon it. But at the same time, that is the way that we did it how many ever years ago. So that said, I'm so glad that people can listen to that work.
But before we talk through the album and we want to kind of go quickly track by track, I'm just curious how your process for writing this score, how you and David worked together or how the whole thing started.
Well, the whole thing started, David had come over to my studio to ask me about teaching at Columbia. And then on his way out, and I will never forget this, and this was way before the election and way before he was the victim of a crime, he said, you know, I have this idea. And then he told me the idea, and I thought, that's a golden idea. That is a really amazing idea. That will be really hard. And it took a little while. He had a version, of course, that was before the election. And then the election happened, and then his stabbing happened. And I wasn't sure the lens with which we were going to see the work, or that I was going to figure out, you know, in a way, we were both playing Chinese authors. I was playing a Chinese composer. And then I thought, oh, if there was a way that they could use the musical as inspiration, because it was in the future, but not quite get it, that was my way in.
And it's so amazing because, you know, the songs do grow so organically out of the scenes. It's all so integrated. And yet, as you alluded to already, you know, it's a rather difficult concept. And, you know, we are obviously, as the audience, have the benefit of seeing the finished product. But you started with a blank page. So I'm curious, from a composition point of view, what was the first piece that you tackled in terms of writing the score?
Oh, wow. That is such a good question. I'm not sure what exactly the first one was. I know that I Am was definitely up there, because we were trying to figure out our own voice and the voice of these two Chinese artists. And that's what was so difficult. So I was trying to find out, you know, so not everything wasn't a pastiche in a way that we were really using our own hearts and our own voices to get in there. And also my love of the form, the form of American musical theater is very difficult to wrangle. And I love that these two writers, you know, and that they're giving it a try. And it comes from a deep love of it. That, I think, was the foremost, that we weren't mocking it, that we were really saying, you know, we're trying something on. In a way, it's an appropriation.
And it's such a fascinating task for you as a composer, I would imagine, to also be playing a role, because that's not typically the case, right? You know, you had to assume the identity of another writer in order to write this score, right?
Yeah. It was maybe one layer. You know, it's a very ambitious premise, and it forced me to look at work in a new way. And usually, it's just through the character that you're thinking. Yeah, and everything you write, you're in that character somewhere. But this was, you're writing as another writer writing for a character. So it is a lot of, you know, if it were a pastry, it would definitely be a croissant.
Yeah. I think a croissant that's filled with something.
Right.
Oh, I like it.
Well, let's dig into the album. I think obviously the place to start would be with the overture. Did you always intend to write an overture, or was there a moment where you debated whether or not to do it?
Always an overture, always. I love overtures. And I you know, the last overture I wrote, because overtures are not in style anymore.
Right. No.
The last one was Millie, and I had to do a lot of versions before that one. I think the Millie overture is successful, but man, it took me a while. And there are those great overtures that just say, sit down, you're here. Be here now. And then the horns go bloop, 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 bloop. And it's so delightful. But now it's just dun da 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 dun 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 ba da da. You know, how does it but you're just right in. So I do it now too. Ba da 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 da. You're just right in.
Right.
So it was really fun. I wanted to use the overture as a juxtaposition against something. The tuning for me has always been very mysterious. It's all filled with anticipation as every player. And we had 23 people. So their version of what an A is and finding the A. And as you know, in Chinese, a Chinese orchestra, when I was there in China, and you have a section of erhu, and deciding on an A is not the thing. Much like their language, the pitch information goes in a spectrum. It's not like a 440, which used to be in Bach's time a different number. So that was the tuning to me was a great metaphor of the whole thing of, yes, can we find one note? Does it matter? Mm. I don't know.
Wow. And I'm curious, I imagine the overture was probably something you wrote after having a sense of the full score, right? So you could pick which theme would be the one, or is it something that you write as you're going along?
Well, when we were putting this together over a series of many readings, it used to be that the monologue was actually in juxtaposition in a very ironic way about what was happening. So he'd say, and I was stabbed, and then the orchestra would say, dun da da dun da da dun da da da, and it was competing. So we dropped that. That was an idea that was what I call the playbill note, where you'd have to really read about it. It wasn't working in real time. It was an interesting idea that didn't work. And I did want the orchestra to usher us into the different time, into this other space through the tuning, and then you know, literally sound the portal through which this character is going. And it turns out he's going deep into his unconsciousness, and what better way to do that than with a string section?
Mm. When we had Lee Silverman on the show last year, she kept on saying that The Wizard of Oz was your North Star. And I love that idea of stepping into a different world. And it's so clearly, you know, happens in this with this one piece of music.
Yes, it's true.
I am dutiful. I am Chinese.
Yes, you are dutiful. You are Chinese.
I get it. I am dutiful.
We are Chinese.
So moving on to the sort of, I guess you would say, opening number, the first sung piece in the show, which is Dutiful. You know, both the overture and this song, to me, instantly evoke sort of the sound and the sensibility of Rodgers and Hammerstein, which I know, you know, you as and the whole writing team took as inspiration for the show as being sort of a reverse King and I. I'm wondering if that is something that you were thinking about, if it was deliberately in your mind to be sort of quoting Rodgers and Hammerstein, or is it all just sort of, you know, musical theater and it all the inspiration sort of melds together?
It was definitely golden age. We were trying to, that's what we were aiming for. And we're certainly aiming for the sound. That's why I wanted the orchestra. When there were budget concerns, which I understood, and I said in a non-aggressive way, it has to be with an orchestra or it won't make its point. If you don't want an orchestra, let's not do it, which I'm fine with. Because you have to have a string section. You can't have 12 pieces. It's not chamber. South Pacific with 12 pieces is very different than with the sound of, you know, the omniscience of an orchestra. So with something like Dutiful, and I was also looking at the tropes of you know, the ship coming into port and the plane and the idea of a child who is afraid, or the of a teaching song, the adult, but we're completely reversing them and yet evoking a time where that kind of music, all of those composers, so many of them, Vincent Humans, Richard Rodgers, Irving Berlin, George Gershwin, they had a deep classical knowledge. So we were trying to write in that vein.
Stop and think of your grandpa and the sacrifice he made for family. Now dry your tears and smile.
Papa, I'm afraid. Papa, I am scared for you. What is this, America? You don't belong in America.
It's a rock.
Papa,
you
I'm
can
afraid.
Hold.
Moving on to Welcome to America now, which is a very different type of song thematically and musically. It's a rap song in many ways. Was that the first time you ever wrote a rap song?
I guess it's a rap song. We were just trying to figure out how, rhythmically to change and to have had listened to, again, a lot of versions. These were people like what I was doing with the Golden Age, they would be doing with the modern musical. Mm. So it was people looking back at people looking back. It was all of these. I just wanted something. And I was saying to someone in the cast, is anybody really comfortable with spitting? And then Gina said, yes, I can do it. And so we just wrote something for her on the spot. It was totally... She just did some stuff and then we wrote it on there. Just really, it was more to, again, just to carry us from one place to another.
But it also, to me, it really sounds like you're setting the tone for this America that's been created, correct?
Yeah.
Like stylistically, right. That moment beautifully sets up this not characterization of America, but this heightened sense of what people think America is.
Yes, we also wanted to, I know, and I, we talked about our experiences all the way through. And because it was a predominantly Asian American cast and crew, orchestra, creative team, we had that point of view. They were in the room. And yet we were all, when we talked about flying into JFK, that feeling of just being assaulted, when we used to fly in there, that it's like, I don't ever still know, where are you going? Where am I going? Where are the cabs? It's now you have to take a plane to a train to a, you know, arrows on the floor and an elevator and an escalator to get to a cab. And I think if I were coming from another country, I would be absolutely lost. I'm already lost and I live here.
Yeah.
So it's that emotionally feeling like, especially before there was that crackdown about people saying, you want to ride? Cab. And, that was the experience there. So we wanted to bring that to the forefront.
Need a ride?
Save your soul.
Want a Rolex?
Help me out.
Need a guide?
Yo, welcome to our crazy fucking country. But you know I will protect you. I see you're not white, but you know I will respect you with your gold billfold. So let me be your guide. Yo, I can see in all directions because I'm round-eyed. Bang, bang. Dirty, hairy, bang, bang. I'm your ride. With my crucifix and gun, I'll shoot a hole in your side. Bang, bang.
Moving on to Fusheng Park. This to me is another song that really demonstrates the value of having that full string section.
Mm-hmm.
It's so sweeping and beautiful. There's a particular melodic theme in this song that shows up elsewhere in the score.
Mm-hmm.
That da 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 da. And someone consuming a musical, there's a lot going on in a musical, so you don't necessarily pick up on that the first time that you see it. And it's operating, of course, right, on you, and you might not be able to figure out, what exactly is happening. But I've noticed that, and I'm wondering if you could speak to that particular theme itself and, why it does show up elsewhere in the score.
10,000
Yes.
Beautiful.
Or maybe more.
Or China.
Shaded paths that seem to stretch to the sea. The place where he felt free. Fushing Park.
I did a cultural exchange. You know, when I was in my 20s, I produced a hundreds and hundreds of hours of world music. It's mm-hmm. part of how I was trained. And, you know, just in the studio and in China and in different countries and in the South here, symphonies, front porch, peepaw players. And when I was in China, I remember I remember the feeling of it and also the beauty of the flutes and some of the sparse way that they would play in octaves and the flutes would sort of dip down, the Tai Chi, hundreds of people doing Tai Chi in the streets, and the pentatonic, and you know those movements and the sparseness of it is for me was so evocative. It had beauty and sorrow and longing, and yet when you put it starts the overture, gong 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 kaboom. Dung, 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 dung. So it could be anywhere. Mm. And then when you have it in a different orchestration and it's sparse and people are slowly moving across the stage, I thought it would dramatize the pull of an Asian American to his home country.
There's also something that I've noticed about the score, thematically, it seems to me, and we'll certainly get more into this with the next song, I'm With Her, that so many of the moments that are more sort of grounded and earnest and poignant are the songs that are an exchange between characters who are in the reality of the piece Asian American or Asian, and then the songs sort of anchored by the white people, who were played by Asian American actors for the most part in the show, are more ironic or satirical. Was that just, stepping back from the whole piece, was that, a choice that you all made, or is it just sort of came from the situations?
I think it did come from the situation, but I think, hearing you say that, I think that feels correct. And I think because the protagonist or the shared protagonist path is these two men who sort of for me are the split between where your family came from and where your family is. Mm. And the idea of the perpetual foreigner and the pain that I've heard so many people, our cast mostly, because we heard them speak so often about what it's like to, as David would say, go around with this face, and this face being a signifier of being the other. And I, of course, don't have that. I have a different journey. And it didn't occur to me until I really stopped and listened. So I think I wanted to really concentrate on my most authentic voice for Shui Xing and for DHH. Mm.
Well, moving on to that next song, I'm With Her, David credits you with coining the term delivery system to describe how musicals operate. And this show obviously very clearly demonstrates this idea, but so does this song in particular. I feel like it's the first sort of like up-tempo, classic kind of musical theatery song that you really, experience. And of course, it's anchored by the Hillary Clinton character, who is a rather, heightened personality as well. I'm wondering, when you went about writing a song like I'm With Her, is it challenging to quote musical styles without them sounding like parodies? Because, you already alluded to the fact that you didn't want to write pastiches. You wanted to write songs that authentically felt like they were embodying the style.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think that people have always said that about my work. Some people love it. Some people really do not. I mean, it's been made clear to me both ways. And then the beauty of age is that you give less and less of a expletive here. but I think that I have, and maybe it's because I didn't go to graduate school. I studied music, but I've always felt like I've been chasing music my whole life. My grandfather was a composer. and died so early and couldn't make a living as a musician. And I, you know, he died pumping gas, and I do feel this real pull from him. And I always feel like I'm just chasing something. I never quite feel, you know, I think that people always say, oh, you're so strong and confident. And I think you have no idea. You have no idea. I mean, I've worked really hard and I've tried to learn as much as possible, but there is the chase of this form. This form is like a slippery fish. And so when there are these tropes I so love, that's what the great fun of this was. I thought, I don't care what people think. I want to just dive head into the things I love about musical theater. And the reason I think they work, just on a rhythmic scale, or the way that you, the rapture of them, and the way that you can go into these, just take a moment, or when you need a shapoopy cigarette break, or when you need this, and just sort of delight in it. And that was the great fun about and she's talking about data. And, you know, we do it in electoral college, which it was really important. We had to take a stand because there was a lot of pressure to cut that. And I was like, I'm not cutting it because it's really important to me that we keep that in, and David as well. And it's that delivery system about you put something, it's that old joke of your sister Rose is dead. And it's funny, because the singing telegram has there's the content, and then there's the way your sister Rose is dead is delivered that makes it funny.
Hello, voters. We got problems. Problems. We got complicated problems all across our nation. Bank reform and global warming. Too much militarization. Problems. I laid out my plans. You can read them now or later. I provided, subdivided all critical data. Ooh, problems.
The thing I love about I'm With Her is the dance break and how it goes from, you know, as you said, like a Music Man, very, very sort of golden age musical. And then there's disco in there. And I didn't even hear, like, when she says pose and the music changes, for the first time today on my 9th or 10th listen, I heard a little bit of, like, disco or a little bit of, like, Marvin Hamlish 70s musical. And it was so delicious to be able to, it's like peeling an onion. Every time I listen, there's another layer that you get to, and it's just a delight.
I think that what we decided about these writers, where they were sort of at the beginning of writing musicals, when you tend to just be, you know, spitting out things that you have in your ear before you develop and you synthesize something, and then your own voice comes out. And so it's just this buffet of like this and that and that, and then you just write. And so we caught them at this moment that they were, they just, without even knowing that they were writing in the styles of all of these writers.
There's also a really incredible metaphor at work in that moment, right? Because she's you know, doing her campaign pitch, right? And she's switching styles. She's sort of code switching to appeal to different sectors of the electorate, right? So first it's swing, then it's hip hop, and then she does a tap dance, you know, and it's entertaining and it's funny, but it also reveals, you know, something so true about our electoral system, which, you know, is later directly said, it's all a big, big show, right? And how a politician sort of has to schizophrenically be all things to all people. They have to tap dance and rap and do swing.
Correct. Correct. And also, I think because it's so, as you said, it's become so performative. And there are these, that's why I think watching Hillary or any woman, but particularly Hillary, is when you see early in her career, what she was asked about in Arkansas were about table settings. There's one reel where you see question after question after question about table settings in particular. And that was so painful for me. Then there's also the allusion to code switching that happens with Asian men. You know, the Asian American men, there's an emasculation that I think that happens. And they have to constantly, a lot of people have to code switch. A lot of people of color have to code switch in this country for the comfort of other people. You know, Black men in particular have to do something with their anger so that it's digestible for other people. Otherwise, it's too much. And so we watch her go through the same thing, but it's manifest in different styles of music, as you said.
Moving on to It Just Takes Time, you know, that song is another, you know, really clear manifestation of the idea of a reverse King and I, because here you have, you know, Xing teaching Hillary something, which are, you know, the tones of the Mandarin language. During that virtual listening party that we were both talking about, someone asked you directly if it was challenging incorporating the Mandarin tones into the composition of the music for this song. And you responded very candidly, quote, "It was a nightmare." And you said, "mostly because I can't learn it. So I was just writing what was impossible for my ear to hear." I was wondering if you could expand on that idea of writing something that you can't hear.
Well, it didn't have to. The writing of that song actually flowed pretty well because I cannot to date say Shui Xing properly. And every time I say it, the you know, people are like, they look at me. I can't. It's not in my ear. It's like German. I cannot speak German. I lived there for a year. I have a pretty good ear, but I can't hear it. And I think it's maybe because I play a well-tempered instrument, or I don't know. And so it was so frustrating, but I really loved turning it, you know, dum, bum, 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 which is the opposite of bum, bum, bum. Let's start at the very beginning.
In Chinese, there are four tones. Each tone changes the meaning of the word. The first tone is flat, high-pitched and floating.
How lovely not to talk about voting.
Xing.
Sing.
Xing.
Sing.
Xing.
Sing.
Xing.
Sing.
Xing.
Sing.
No, that's not really it.
When you see how Americans have just not ever, for me, considered ourselves citizens of the world. Mm. I feel like the United States of America are not united. They're the states of America. I feel like every state feels like a country. And so when you really look at who we are with everything, and I feel like we're patriots, we fight for this country. But when you really look at it, it's so jarring to see someone teach an American how to speak. It was really great because it's absolutely true. We do not push people to be bilingual or trilingual here. And there's so many of our European friends speak 3-4 languages because there is a fluidity there and not here because we've sort of been isolationist. So it was hard to do because I had to get the you know, learning about the tones. I also had to feel like, oh, wait, that's wrong, and then organize it. Organizing it was the nightmare.
Let's start at the very beginning. A very good place to start. Where
when you read, you begin with
ABC.
When you sing, you begin with Do, Re, Mi.
Do, Re, Mi.
Do, Re, Mi. The first three notes just happen to be Do, Re, Mi.
Do, Re, Mi.
Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, Ti.
Come, I'll make it easier for you. Listen.
I also find just, you know, personally, because I, you know, we've talked about this, but, you know, I know Hillary Clinton and I've worked for her for 12 years. And I loved this moment because a leader, you know, who was sort of open-hearted enough and to want to learn something and to witness her struggling with it. And, you know, have her outbursts, but ultimately, you know, getting it and learning something, you know, and having that cultural exchange. I thought it was it was part of, you know, to your earlier point about not wanting to make fun of the characters or the form, you know, I feel like the song is a perfect example of you achieving on that goal because it humanizes both characters and is also such a celebration of the form itself.
I feel like what we wanted to do, especially with Hillary, is I do think that part of me died that day that she lost, that night, I would say. I mean, I feel like there's a part I will never get back. And I still hear the cries of my daughter sobbing. I've never heard the sounds coming out of my daughter 2 years ago when she was 20 and she came in. And it wasn't just about Hillary, and it was completely about Hillary. It was about something we thought was possible, and perhaps Ms. Clinton knew on some level that they were never going to give it to her. Mm. And so I just felt the ceiling lower. And that is just, it was a reality check of like, oh, right. That thing, here it is. And so I didn't want anybody to be, there was no mocking. There was an idea of underneath what we want from our politicians, this perfection we ask of the women in charge, the way that we want to, no matter in bipartisan or not, you're wrong. It's like, okay, I might be wrong about that. Let me check. And this desire to publicly shame people, to bring them down a notch, I find it so insufferable. And so I feel like that was really behind our desire to say this woman has been at the service, like her or not like her, or any politician, except for the politicians we know who are absolutely corrupt and you know, make up their own facts, and the leadership of this country. But, you know, the service, the years of sacrifice, I can't even imagine being in the public eye like that.
Yeah.
Is that one of the reasons that it was so important that you keep election night and not cut it?
The reason that the election night for me, and that you know, we each had our sort of flags to fly, and that was definitely mine. I remember saying to a couple of really smart people, I said, I've cut more work. I'm like, if I were a pie maker, there'd be crust all over my floor, but nobody understands how the electorate system works in this country. Nobody. Even the people understand it. For me, they cannot explain it to people in a way. Like, I wish that Governor Cuomo would explain it, because he would be like, I loved his explanation of the federal and the state level. He's like, the federal is like a paint roller. And the roller, you just roll the paint. And then at the state level, you come in with a brush on the corners. That's the state. And I thought, you just explain everything to us.
Yeah, really?
You know, he's so delightful with that. But it is impossible. It's impossible. I know that there was a desire not to have direct democracy, but it is ludicrous as a system. And so I just had to hammer home that during this oompa, 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 that there is this incredibly dense, impossible, it should be understandable, comprehensible, and it is not, and we have to have it.
Each of the 50 states receives a number of electors equal to its total number of senators and representatives.
Wait.
The electors are pledged to vote for the candidate of the party unless they choose not to.
What?
The winner, the majority of votes in each state, take all the states
electors in a winner-take-all system. Why? The Electoral College ensured that smaller and rural states had a disproportionate say in selecting a president.
Which in the early days of our great nation ensured they could keep their slaves. Hail, hail, the word of the ballot. Hail, hail, the word of the ballot.
And the next president of the United States is...
the word of the ballot.
Not Hillary Clinton.
It's very well, you've done a very good job of explaining it. You really have.
Thank you.
But I also love, you know, sort of musically how you're bopping along to this, you know, really delightful, fun song. But if you pay attention to the words, it's like, oh, yeah, this is actually really quite demented. And then when you shift to the portion where it's now on to the college, the Electoral College, suddenly the melody isn't as hummable, right? Suddenly it becomes a little more discordant because what you're describing becomes so much more inexplicable and confusing.
There used to be this section and we had to cut it because it didn't quite work, where he would do that whole section and then throw it to them. And there would be 30 seconds of everybody trying to repeat it. And I loved it, but it didn't work. So we had to cut it, but it was, to your point, we're trying to dramatize this. That is not something that anyone could ever sing unless you really studied it for a very long time.
And then we move on to I Am, which, you know, closes out Act One. And you mentioned earlier was one of the earlier pieces that you had written. And this song, to me, you know, sort of echoes back to Dutiful, which started Act One, in that, you know, that the lyric being I am Chinese. You know, I am American is what he sings, but he also, you know, is embracing that two-faced nature that you were talking about, having to sort of straddle those two identities.
Xing, you've helped me see I don't have to play a role. I'm not two halves, I'm whole. Enough just as I am. It's something to be proud of. I guess that's love. I am Chinese. I am American.
The last 10 years, but specifically the last 2 years, I've been really interested in the precision of language in musical theater. And the idea of what justice really, what it really means. And, you know, I took a law course there so I could understand, because the justice system works in metaphor the same way that theater works, that you see two lawyers presenting your story, your narrative, to a little audience of 12 people and letting them decide, like as an audience, what your fate is going to be. And this idea of being from one and being from another, and the state of limbo. And when I took a course called Dismantling Racism, they were saying that one of the costs of however, if you consider yourself a white American, is this isolation, this you're divorced from your culture. So, and I feel that as an Italian American, I have memories of people speaking Italian and memories of all the kinds of cooking. Can I make it? I cannot. Can I speak it? I cannot. I speak music Italian. And it was almost this very intentional, we are not there anymore. We are American. And along the way, we lost a lot of that. And so I think there's a feeling about floating in the sea. And how does one integrate one's culture and become, quote, an American? And I think that is the state of limbo that song addresses.
I am afraid. Sadness isn't useful. Emotions mustn't guide you. Feelings always pass. They always. is this America? Why do I cry for America?
So moving on to Act Two, you know, begins with the entr'acte, which of course is another convention of musical theater that I assume you knew you had to have, you know, an entr'acte. And then Song of the Campaign, which we already talked about, you know, sort of your motivation behind wanting to address the way that women are perceived in politics. And that's, to me, is what this song is really about.
I wanted to, you know, also following the panel, which was to me my favorite part of the show. I wish we could have recorded it, but I've always been interested that they call it the campaign trail. So the trope, dun da dun da dun da dun dun, of what must it feel like to be in six cities in one day? It's like, what must that feel like, you know, to just be like slogging it out, and what you have to do. And how exhausted you must be when you even start to lead, the amount of money that's been spent and the time spent persuading people. I mean, it just, I don't understand it, but that's the feeling I wanted to evoke when that was just the hardship.
Yeah. Well, I worked on that campaign and I experienced it. My particular job was doing the briefing book for the secretary. So I was very much, talk about the trail, you know, I was living each day with her, and then it became all the other super surrogates who were on the trail as well, which was a whole other challenge. But putting it lightly, thank you for speaking to that, because I, you know, for me as someone who was on the inside and then now, you know, obviously is experiencing a work of art that's reflecting it back to me, it's so satisfying to see the recognition of the work, because, you know, I sat back from the 2016 campaign and thought, we worked so hard, we did so much, we poured so much into this, and then it was just gone in, you know, in a flash. And much like the theater, it was so ephemeral. You know, there was nothing tangible that you could really, you know, carry forward. Mm-hmm. But in particular with the song, I want to share with you, because I shared this with Elise when we talked to her. You know, I know the secretary didn't get a chance to see the show while it was at the Public. But we talked about it, you know, because I saw the show and I wrote about it and we had them on the podcast. And I told her about this particular scene. This was the one that I wanted to tell her about. And I said, well, you know, she's singing the song while eating pizza and ice cream. And, you know, it's this whole visual, you know, thing you can experience. And I sat back and I was like, I don't know if that's, you know, if that was the most accurate thing. And she laughed and said, well, not far from the truth, you know. So
that's fantastic.
You all tapped into something there that, yeah. You know, is you know, not only perhaps true for her, but also just so universally human, right? Mm-hmm. That like any one of us is suffering a setback. What do we want to do? We just want to sit in our, you know, pajamas and eat ice cream. You know, I mean, it's so human.
I think the human thing also is, and it's one thing that we wrote about so much of the time in Fun Home, is that just the need to be parented. I don't care how old you are. I think the state of being alive is the need to be led well. That's what we look to our leaders. I think that our leaders were looking to them to be parented well. And that's not about to be placated or patronized. It's to be organized and to be true and to do the best you can and to set a tone. And so I could feel that, because one of the things that I wanted to have her having comfort food, because one has to be comforted in that time. And so I'm glad that got that response.
I haven't washed my hair or changed my clothes in 10 days. 10 days of Hillary make a statement. You're Hillary, we were so damn sure. Hillary, now you are just like Gore. Hillary, poor Hillary, poor Hillary, poor Hillary, poor Hillary. No more interviews, no more photo ops, because I'm never running for president ever again.
I wonder, however, if the secretary can sing while eating ice cream as well as Elise can.
I don't know. I would love to have a challenge.
Amazing. So the next song is Happy Enough, which is another really beautiful moment. And here, sort of for the first time, you see the character of Hillary having one of those moments I spoke about earlier of, you know, sort of the earnest, non-ironic, non-satirical, you know, exchange with Shui Sing. Now I'm saying his name wrong. I was wondering if you could tell us about, sort of the way that this moment dramatically comes together, and then obviously with the song.
Well, when I was listening to it was extraordinary being around having so many Korean American, Japanese American, Vietnamese American, Chinese American, Filipino American, everybody, and sort of sharing what the culture, Asian American parents, Asian parents, and the commonality that, you know, what they had in common. And this idea of what you, I think the farewell did it. You know, this idea of what's performative, of what's the distance between what your interior, what you are in your essence, and what your identity is. Joseph Campbell talks about that all the time. And so their identities have met. She is the strong girl, blah, blah, blah. He is the strong Asian, you know, the courage and no emotion, and that, and then their essences meet, and they in telling each other what's happening behind that, behind the wall, in a way, that becomes love, that when you really know the way that someone is authentically operating. And so that was really the motor for that song.
Your people, they never get to see this side of you.
This part I keep for myself.
You have to save face.
Now we both know what we hide from the world. And isn't that love?
Is that love?
Isn't that love?
Is that love to lose your face and open your heart?
And I love too that the love that they share is that that complicated and deep and profound. It's not a silly romance that gets mythologized. It's an actual relationship that, you know, has depth to it.
Yeah, it's I think again the delivery system. You know, RNH. I love them. What they wrote. They wrote about in South Pacific in Carousel. They wrote of their time and ahead of it. And now when you look back at that time, you know, of course, there are issues with it, because I don't, except for Hamilton in 1776, there are very few musicals that pay specific attention to history. And so one shouldn't look at learning history from The King and I. But I think when you look at the exchange inside the love song, and still it's with that romantic sound of two people that have a mutuality, that to me is the where the dissonance is. It's like, wait, they're both giving and taking. It's not one character saying, you know, love him no matter what. He'll leave you. He'll like ignore you. He might hit you. You love him. And I think, I don't want to write that.
The thoughtless things you do will hurt and worry you. Then all at once you'll do something wonderful. He has a thousand dreams.
Well, moving on to the White House with good guy with a gun. You and I had a little colloquy about this during that virtual listening party. But the song begins with a very clear ode to Aaron Copland and later directly quotes Simple Gifts. I was wondering if you could talk to us about the decision to incorporate those references in this song in particular.
I think the exuberance that anybody who is on the far right and waving the flag of family, of values, and then it reminds me of when I was raised a Roman Catholic, and I remember the priest saying, it's one thing to be in here and listening to me, and then I see a lot of you in the parking lot just not treating each other well as you stream out of here. If you're going to live it, live it. And that, you know, I didn't listen a lot when I was younger and in church because I was just dreaming about not being in church. But that went in, right? It's like when you take yoga and they say it's not about the mat. It's not about sitting in the pew. It's about living those things. Mm. And so I think it was the same way that I know that for the Second Amendment, that there are people who really stand by their need to bear arms. I get it. But in this country, it has, as we all know, developed in something that is horrific. It's horrific what has happened. And it's behind the banner of don't you take away my, you know, don't take it away. It's like, oh, my God, that was from a different time and place. And now it just feels so late. And I've heard it quoted that saying, you know, when something horrific happens and someone will say, well, that's the price of freedom. I think, is it the price of freedom? So, and yet when you listen to people who are defending it, they feel and consider themselves to be absolutely good guys with a gun. That's a quote. That's a quote that David, right. that David used from a politician. They feel that they are correct. So we didn't want to, you know, it's to me, it's not about mocking it. It's about someone who actually might share that ideology and think, that's right. That's right. That's how you defend your home.
No American would throw away his gun. Come on!
Good guy with a gun. Good guy with a gun. That's why no
Correct me if I'm wrong, but in an earlier draft or iteration of the show, as you were developing it before the outcome of the 2016 election, was there more of a focus on guns and gun violence in terms of the storyline, or am I just?
It was everywhere through there. I don't know. I think that, you know, in LA for sure, everybody had a gun. Everybody pulled out a gun, and I think we were reacting to the fact that we all felt that everybody was just pulling out guns all the time and killing people. And I don't know where we are now because we're in a new world, but there were many, it seemed like confused and angry young men, particularly young white men who had no like a place to place their aggression and confusion, apprehension. And they had an opportunity to have a weapon and make people pay for, I guess, what they couldn't metabolize. I'm just guessing at all of this. And I feel like we were trying to put that into the show. But then there was a feeling that, and I think it was true, that it was upstaging a lot of the other messages going on. And it's not a show about gun violence. It's a show about America.
It's interesting, though, as the show progressed from Los Angeles to San Francisco and then to the Public Theater, and with that course of time, over, you know, that period of time, and as you continue to work on the show, it's amazing how at this moment in the show, from Good Guy with a Gun to the end, how much clearer and sharper your message became. And moments that I didn't remember feeling as ominous in San Francisco felt much more ominous at the Public, and moments that I don't remember being as hopeful felt way more hopeful at the Public. So it's interesting how it the message became so much sharper as the piece went on. I mean, the work on the piece.
I'm glad. I mean, it's really gratifying to hear you say that, because I think that's what we were really trying to do with something it's a very ambitious piece. And trying to match the skill with the ambition is hard. And as Sondheim always says, that clarity, clarity, clarity. And we wanted to end with for me, it's the moral imperative to end with hope, because I'm not really interested in something that doesn't make me want to either go write or read more or ask something or talk with the person next to me about what I just saw. The fact that it activates something in a Brechtian sense, I feel like Brecht, I'm not a Brechtian scholar, but the feeling I've always gotten from Brecht is that you left there and you felt like there was work to do.
Yeah.
Like Tony Kushner, the great work begins. Mm. And so I feel like we wanted to do that, and we wanted to, you know, as with always in a musical, it's a house of cards. How Prince always said that, and he was so true. I think it's Jenga, naked Jenga. And
naked Jenga.
Naked Jenga. That.
Yeah, well, the song "The New Silk Road," you know, which sort of carries, you know, is part of this crescendo towards the end of the show, to me has only become more poignant in the months since the show played at the Public. I mean, it's like with this pandemic and obviously, you know, U.S.-China relations just sort of continuing to escalate, and this war of words, and you know, this idea of us coming together and learning from each other, you know, like it has only come into higher relief.
It was such an interesting, the press briefing today with Cuomo, and every time they were saying something about the escalation and testing, or he was like, well, the chemicals are made in China. Yes, those swabs are, you know, China kept being mentioned. And I thought, boy, that, you know, President Trump better be very careful about the language he uses about China right now, because we seem to be depending on them an awful lot. And I don't know if you saw in The Economist, there's this idea that after this, China will clearly, I don't know if it's clearly, but it's arguable that they will be leading the way forward.
Well, I mean, you know, the show was called Soft Power for a reason, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, that notion of how a country can expand its power non-coercively, but through other means, you know, one of those means is through the economy, right? That we're certainly experiencing that. You know, there's another musical quote that I couldn't help but hear at the end of this song, which I don't know if it's intentional or maybe I'm just fantasizing it. But is there a sort of an allusion to "You'll Never Walk Alone" from Carousel?
Yes, yes, there is. Oh, only you would get that. But, you know, it's that raised fifth. Bom, yeah. Bom, 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 bom. And I wanted to do it in this Beethovenian way in the a cappella section, because nationalist music is always super uncomfortable for me. And,
oh, yeah.
And yeah, it's like, what's happening? And it's so beautiful. And when you look at Nazi Germany and some of that music, and you're like, please make it stop. Because the beauty and the revelation of the evil and the way that those two things meet, it's so uncomfortable.
Let's come together. Let us help forget what we are owed. Walk beside.
Well, getting back to the note of hope, Democracy, which obviously is first sung by Hillary and then in the reprise sung by the full ensemble. I had to laugh. Sam Pinkleton called this the love on top of musical theater in that listening party. How many modulations are there in this song? Is it possible to know?
47.
Amazing. Well, what strikes me about this song, other than the fact that I'm just obsessed with it, is that in a rather stark departure from the rest of the entire score, it has sort of an R&B feel to it. And I was wondering why you decided to use that idiom for this moment in the show.
I think because I feel like Secretary Clinton is a super badass. And I wanted her to sing like a super badass.
Yeah.
And I wanted her for one moment to be able to go to church. And I wanted her to just like be sexy. And because I think she's sexy. And she's a woman. And I think the desire for us to make a masculine, you know, being out of her makes me very angry. And it came more from a feeling of how I wanted that moment to go, because I do think that it's a plea. I think it's a prayer. I think it comes from a deep place. And I think of theater as church and the theater of politics and the idea that it's coming from a deep belief. I think it's a deep, deep belief. I believe in it. It's very hard to put together with what's happening and try to predict what will happen to it. But at its best, if we can really imagine a way that democracy could work, I think that's where it comes from.
I swear I'll give it up before it downright kills me. Then it comes back again with promises that thrill me. And I forget what I really should know. And I forget that it's just a big, democracy, democracy, democracy.
And there's an idea expressed in the lyrics that, for me, you know, being as despondent as I was, and I imagine everyone else, you know, to have been in the wake of the 2016 election, you know, when I heard the song in L.A., and the words in particular, it was, in fact, one of the first times I felt hope. Because of the very clear articulation of the idea that we have the power, right? It's so easy to get swept up and to feel powerless and particularly to be made to feel powerless. But what the song expresses to me, at least, is that idea that democracy means us, right? And it takes all of us. And if we want to change it, we're the ones who have to do it.
Right.
And for Hillary Clinton to be delivering that message, right? The person who should be the most cynical, the most upset, the most willing to walk away and say, you know what, screw all of you. For her to say, I still believe in democracy.
Right.
Is such a powerful moment, both in you know, the words and the delivery of it. And then to have that full ensemble sing those words. You know,
right.
an entire cast of Asian American actors facing the audience and saying those words is incredibly powerful.
It was, you know, when we had a small listening party, of course, with just the orchestra and the cast. Mm-hmm. And that was right when Matt Stein had finished mixing. And it was the start of, as you know, a new wave of xenophobia and racism. Mm. Some of our cast had been spit on, yelled at. And to see them together in that song. And then as it ended, it was the first time the 7 p.m. clapping in Manhattan started. And I just thought, those are those beacons that you look to. Whatever one believes, it's the idea of morality, of the ethical imperative to your civic responsibility, you know, the good and bad, those ideas, boy, they really, those are what I think the fundamentals I really look to, those of treat people well, treat yourself well, treat people well and fairly, repair, reparations with all that looks like, and looking at all of their faces. Well, in the wake of that, it was right after Trump had called the virus the Chinese virus. Mm. And the recklessness with which he uses language matters. And it really mattered that day.
Mm. Well, you alluded to this answer a moment ago, but I feel like since we asked David and we asked Lee and Francis and Elise this question, although it meant something different in November of last year, I have to ask you, do you still believe in democracy?
Oh, absolutely. I do. I do because I can't. I do. It's one of the reasons I didn't want to leave New York City. I didn't leave New York City after 9/11. I'm not leaving now. I feel like when you really... Tony Kushner said this to me when we were... He was stuck in... I think he was in Ireland after 9/11, and I was sick about it. I was so worried about so many things but him. And I'm so worried now. And we were talking about leaving, and he said, you can't leave. You have to stay in the conversation. Mm-hmm. And the way he said it wasn't in a punishing kind of way. He was like, the wrestle with it, but the imagination, imagining a time, imagine what democracy looks like. For me, that's the whole point. It's a messy system. And I think when people would like it to be really neat, but I don't, you know, do I stand by what's happening in this country right now? I do not. But I also look to the people who are taking a stand, and this next generation, and the people who I know who are activating something incredibly important. And I do imagine a better time, so I do believe in it.
Look, this country's a disaster in so many ways, but we have the power. We have the power. We have the power to change. That's why I believe in. I know. I believe. Oh, I believe. I believe in democracy.
Well, thank you so much for being so generous with your time and talking through the entire
album
to Soft Power for us. I have to say, before we let you go, you just mentioned Tony Kushner, and we cannot have you on the show without talking ever so briefly about Carolina Change, which is one of our absolute favorite musicals, speaking for both of us. We were so thrilled when Roundabout announced that they were going to... push the revival that had been scheduled for the spring to next season. Just very briefly, what can you tell us about this new production and what it's been like returning to the show 17 years after it began at the Public?
The beauty of this production, and I'm so pleased that it's not canceled and postponed, is it's so different from the first production. And it really is Michael Longhurst's version of it. And that is delightful because I feel like what the original cast, what George C. Wolfe did, what all of those designers did was very, very specific. And along comes Michael Longhurst, who's never directed a musical before. Mm-hmm. And it's this interpretation of this piece that I think it's really wonderful. And yet still at the source is this relationship and what happens when you tarnish a relationship that is already complicated with an economic obligation. Mm. And it's, when Tony came to me with that idea so long ago, it was like when David said that idea that day, and I thought, this is going to be really hard and worth every minute.
Thank goodness that you did write that show and that we will get a chance to see it again in the very near future. And in fact, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit because I think Rob and I are going to want to do another show on Carolina, an entire show on Carolina Change. So we might be calling you again.
Count me in. And also, I do know there was an agency and they had, you know, in one of the Zoom parties, it was a theme and everybody came as their favorite character of a musical. And a very prominent agent came as the washing machine. And I have a picture. And it makes me laugh every day. It's delightful and very specific.
Wow. So all right. Well, that steals the thunder of my Halloween costume, which is pocket change. Lastly, and we ask every single person, including Secretary Clinton, this question. And that question is, what was that thing that made you want to do what you do now? Was there a specific show or moment that made you want to compose music?
Well, there were two moments that are related. One was when I was in music really early and then I left. And then I came back, I went to Stage Door Manor. And the moment I walked into, it was what we called the barn. And it was, that's why I feel like theater is a little like church. And I remember this feeling of being home. And I thought, that's so weird. I don't know how I know how to do this because I haven't been, you know, I quit music for 4 years. And I don't know why I feel such an ease with doing theater because I'd never done it before. So that was absolutely the moment I remember it. And the other one was when my mother gave me the music of my grandfather and the wooden, his music stand and his baton. And it was, again, a feeling of being tied to something, about being tethered to something real. And those two moments is when I knew.
Where is the music stand and baton now?
They're at my mom's.
Oh, excellent. All right. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been a delight, and we are so thrilled to get to continue to listen to this magnificent and powerful score that you have created.
Your enthusiasm and support for this is really, I'm going to need it in the coming weeks, and I appreciate it from both of you.
Well, we look forward to seeing another production of it soon. In fact, we had actually talked about this with Lee and David, which is to see it in rep with The King and I. And that would be, I think, really interesting. But we'll see.
Do one scene and then one scene and then one scene.
That had not been discussed. Now that's really interesting.
I got so many ideas.
Good. All right. Well, thank you so much. And
thank you.
Be well.
And I forget what I really should know. I forget that it's such a big show.
Jamie here. That's our show. Thank you for listening. At this difficult time, please consider making a donation to the Actors Fund at actorsfund.org. The Fabulous Invalid is a production of O&M Etc. and The Fabulous Invalid LLC and a proud member of the Broadway Podcast Network. Our theme music is by Lucky Chops. Today's episode was edited and engineered by Charles Van Kirk. Find us online at thefabulousinvalid.com and on social media at Fabulous Invalid and on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever you find your podcast. Be sure to tune in next Wednesday. Stay well and be safe.
America, this is America.
Look, our country's a disaster.
This is America.
In so many ways, but we have the power.
Good fortune will follow if we somehow survive.
In America.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.